The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Lasting Podcast. My guest today is Kevin Tim from Seek Outside. Is it Seek Outside Tents or Outdoors, or what's the full name?
It is Seek Outside. Okay. Just Seek Outside. A lot of people call us SO or SO. We do more than tents. We also do stoves, backpacks. We sell sleeping bags by Western Mountaineering as well. So we can really kind of get your essentials out pretty well.
So the reason I wanted to have you on is I don't have one of your products, but a buddy of mine does. And we went on a alpine deer hunting trip this last weekend. And I wasn't sure about, like, he was going to pack the whole tent up there. And anytime you hear about a tent with a stove, and then we brought two little starter logs because it was supposed to be rainy and windy and miserable. And I thought, man, this tent's going to be way too heavy to pack up the mountain. It's going to be a huge pain to set up because it's going to catch so much wind. There's just no way this thing is going to work. And it ended up being awesome. And we spent a lot more time in it than I would have liked to because it was foggy. But I posted a picture and people were asking questions about, hey, how does it hold up? And just, so I figured I'm going to talk to an expert because I can't really answer any of these questions. So first of all, I guess the question would be, anytime you're dealing with a light material here in Southeast Alaska, we have been conditioned that light and packable means that it's going to degrade, that it's going to break down, that it's not going to last. So how is it that this tent fabric can be so light and yet durable?
It really goes to the genesis of how it's made, right? It's basically cordura nylon, which is a highly durable nylon it's very lightweight. And then it has a coating which increases its strength, being the silicone coating versus a PU coating, which degrades the strength. And then the way we construct the tents is in such a way that our stress spots are reinforced very well, or they're done in such a way that there's appropriate stitching. And there's more to it than that. There's types of needles you use and all sorts of things that you learn over time. If I may ask, first off, your experience is not unusual. I hear that a lot, where people put a pretty suspicious eye and then they're like, wow, this really kind of changed my game. What was your friend's name?
Ryan.
Okay. So it wasn't, one of our early customers lives in Ketchikan, Chris Foster, I think. And he's had backpacks forever as well. Yeah. So.
You said that there was a coating on it. Does that coating end up degrading over time at all? Or is it, because again, with the amount of moisture we have up, even moisture with storage, is there anything like the longevity is this thing is going to start to degrade over time, or once you get it, like you're good to go and it's the last tent you own in the near future?
Well, there's two primary types of coatings that are used on tents. One is polyurethane. That's what's on the bulk of tents that you will go and buy. PU makes it weak, makes the fabric weaker. It is a good waterproof coating though. And that can degrade over time, and it depends on the quality of the coating. It really does. So some of them will peel, some of them won't. We use a silicone coating, which makes the tent stronger. Silicone coatings somewhat degrade, but not in the same way. It's not like they peel off. They become less waterproof over time. So how we handle that is we have our waterproof rating spec very high. And our expectation is that once it does lose some of that coating over time, it's still going to be sufficiently waterproof for the bulk of uses. And in the worst case, because it's a silicone coating, you can reapply it with some of the silicone coatings you can buy online and stuff, and they will rejuvenate some of that coating. So to answer a more long-term question, we have tents out there that are 8, 9, 10 years old, and we don't have people complaining about them at all.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Chris that lives here. He's had his for a little while, and he's no problems with it.
He has probably had his for 9 or 10 years. He was I think his was a gift from his dad or something like that. He has a very large one as well. I think he was an early user of maybe our 12 man. And then he has a couple other tents as well. So I don't know how many he has. I think he has an Aeolus. And he has one of our packs as well. And he's put that thing through the ringer. And there's been times that he's sent me photos of all the critters he's carried out in his pack that year. And, you know, it's enough to make a guy pretty jealous.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to pursue around here. I'm on your website right now, and there's kind of a Q&A education system or area here, and you can kind of figure out some of the stuff. But there's a, what is Dyneema, or is it Cuban fiber?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, we also make some tents out of that. They are not, by and large, our core product, though. That one will degrade a little faster. That's an awesome fabric, though, makes an awesome tent, and it has some very unique properties that make it very compelling. It's not for the thrifty, and not for the value shoppers. However, the availability of that has become very sporadic this year, the supply chain. So it's not something that we're actively, telling people they should, go by because it's the latest, greatest and stuff. Now, it's some of its compelling things is it's very strong for its weight, and it's extremely light. That being said, that does fit in that you need to take a little more care with it than you do like our nylon tents.
How much has your operation been affected by the supply chain?
A little and a lot. There's been some times that our lead times have gotten extended, like for some reason, tent stakes were hard for us to come by for a while. And even though we had several thousand stakes on order, they were somewhere lost in the shipping world and then showed up like 3 months late randomly. Cuban Dyneema has had some supply chain issues. There's been a little bit of a supply chain issue with the foam we use in our backpacks, but that's due and for a product we call Maddie McMatface, which has a cult following, despite its name. But that was caused by an explosion that happened in the factory. So that probably wasn't really even a COVID-based issue. But it caused them to get behind. There's been some supply chain issues with aluminum in our backpack frames. We've worked through that best we can. And our packs have gotten far more popular the last couple of years as well. So we've really had to scale those up. But on the aluminum, some of it was that I think one of the companies decided to relocate. So during the COVID downturn, they decided to spend a couple months moving their operations and not producing aluminum. So things like that. But it hasn't been as bad as you would think. And frankly, our staff has done a fairly good job of managing everything.
You've been in business for a little while. Have there been things that, like as far as technology, that you've been able to improve? There have been some things that you have kind of worked the kinks out of, or some things that you kind of, you know, didn't work out the way you wanted to, and now you got things pretty dialed in?
Yes, yes, and yes. We're always trying to improve. We do a fair amount of testing. There's some things that we have patents on that took us a while to dial in, right? For instance, our zipperless tents, that's a patent. We have two zipperless tents out now. There's a third one coming, and then probably a fourth and fifth as well a little bit later on. But that took a little bit of experimenting with. To get it working as well as we could. So there's been a little bit of everything. I mean, we weren't perfect from the get-go, but we tried to be as good as we could and to make everything right for customers. And, you know, if we made mistakes, we owned it. We still have that philosophy. It's something we preach to our employees that, you know, I don't really want you covering up mistakes. I'd rather that you own it, learn it, move on from it, let the mistake make you better at what you do. There's been a little bit of all of that, but we keep trying to continuously improve, continuously innovate. We do have some other new items that we're looking forward to introducing in 2022. That I think people will find really compelling as well. Mm-hmm.
Two of the things that I guess were other concerns at first before I was in one of these was, what do you do when you can't find enough flat land up in the Alpine to put the tent down? Then also having a floorless one. And that was one of the things that people were asking me about, like, was it impossible to find a dry enough spot? And how do you manage that with the floor distance? So what products do you have available for wet environments that keeps your pad up off the wetness of the Alpine?
Well,
I had two sheets. I'm not sure what they were made of or anything like that, which were great. And they were bigger than my sleeping pad and then my sleeping bag.
Were they white?
They were light, and it just looked like it almost looked like an absorbent sheet that you would see at like a shop.
It didn't like a hot wrap.
Yeah.
Did it have our logo on it?
Yeah. It was white with a green logo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a house wrap similar to Tyvek for a ground sheet. It's made by a different company, a competing company. They approached us. We actually feel that Tyvek has been used as ground sheets for quite a while. We actually feel that our ground sheet, albeit slightly heavier, has some advantages. One, it's quiet and rolls up. And with Tyvek, you have two types of Tyvek. One is a quiet and one is very loud. And the quiet one's relatively fragile. The other thing I believe that ours has an advantage on is ours has a bunch of small bumps on it. Mm-hmm. Which has a tendency, because a lot of the lightweight sleeping pads are easy to slide around quite easy. It helps stabilize them and protect them a little bit.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
So that's the first thing we have on the ground area. The second is we have liners, which are a second wall that you can put in, which really helps minimize the inevitable condensation. In wet areas, ventilation helps a lot. And then oftentimes, the stove really will dry out the interior. And I know sometimes, I just got back from a caribou hunt in Northeast Alaska, and we had some, it was mostly wet weather, right? Wet and chilly. And so we had some of those same challenges, but the stoves have a tendency to dry out the ground from which the tent is pitched a bit. So while it may be wet when you start out, if you're going to be camped in the same spot for 2, 3, 4 days, then it probably will start to dry out over time. A lot of people in Alaska use the Red Cliff, the tent that you're mentioning. We have quite a crew on Kodiak that uses it religiously. So it's well proven shelter up there.
Yeah, that was super nice to get up off the floor. And then I was really amazed about the lightness of the stove. So can you talk a little bit about how you're able to make a stove portable?
Well, we use a very thin titanium, and we have a couple different versions of the stove. We have our standard box that weighs a little more. And then we have our U-turn, which we introduced a year or so ago, which is a bit lighter and chops off about close to a pound. And that uses like a thin foil around three sides, but the way it's done, it still gives you a flat top, which you can use for cooking, heating, water, things like that. So a lot of it is just how the titanium is done. We use an expensive material. Titanium isn't cheap, but it actually holds up very, very well. Our incidence of any failures in our stoves has been so tiny. It's primarily been with the damper spark arrestor or rods wearing out that you use it to help assemble with. And those, the damper spark arrestor, we introduced a new one a year or so ago, which I don't think anybody will have a problem with again, ever. I think it'll be pretty fail proof. And then the rods, you know, sometimes the hardware, I mean, but you can get a lot of that right at your local hardware store, or we sell those kits. But those have been the only real issues. We've had people use stoves for months at a time on long trips, you know, like if they've stayed out over the winter and stuff.
Mm-hmm. My buddy had the U-turn.
Okay.
And it took a little bit of finagling to get it to fit in there, but it was pretty nice. So there is a cool little damper system. What mm-hmm. are concerns about heat? Because this is the first time he'd actually take it into the Alpine. So it was kind of a trial run. He did a couple practice runs at home, setting it up and everything. And so when it was getting pretty hot and the stove pipe started to turn red,
mm-hmm.
is there like a height at which it becomes maybe a concern, or?
No, not really. It will handle, the titanium is supposed to be good to over 3000 degrees Fahrenheit. The color changing happens usually in the 600 to 1000 degree temperature. I mean, don't touch it, obviously. You know, I've used infrared thermometers to measure temperatures on stuff. I don't think I've ever really gotten much above 1400 as far as a temperature. And, you know, that was trying to build a ridiculously hot fire.
Mm-hmm. We maybe got it, I don't know, wasn't even halfway up the stovepipe, and I wasn't sure that the stove was actually large enough to handle the fire that would enable it to get like all the way the full length of the stovepipe. Are there, I don't know about concerns, but any buildup on the inside of the pipe? Is there some maintenance, or is that just as simple as, you know?
Well, first off, the heat dissipates quickly up the pipe. So it's a good idea early on to flip your pipe so you burn in both ends of it and keep it consistent. But it does, I mean, like I said, I've measured it with infrared thermometers and stuff, and it dissipates fairly quickly going up the pipe. You can get some creosote buildup in there. That depends upon sometimes the type of wood you use. If you use things like Duraflame logs, you're far more likely to get those kind of buildups in there. And in that case, I would recommend either burning it super hot at home or opening up the pipe and wiping out the additional creosote.
We have a couple, or we brought up a couple pressed sawdust logs that they make at the mill around here, so they don't have as many of those chemicals and stuff. It's actually just pressed together and the natural, it's just a natural, awesome log. So it was nice to use that and not have to worry about the chemicals and such.
The natural pressed ones are fine. I mean, if they're like, there's some you can buy on Amazon that are natural pressed. I know there's a place in Idaho that makes some as well. And those are fine. And I mean, there are people that burn Duraflames and stuff. I just can't necessarily recommend them. In a pinch, you can run them, but there is going to be some downsides.
Yeah. So I got to ask about the caribou, you know, being that I'm from Alaska and I do podcasts with Alaskans and people in the lower 48, but tell me about this caribou hunt if you got some time.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, it was quite the adventure. I'll be real. I'll give you the full meal deal on this one. First off, my two sons, Owen and Eli, are 21 and 18. I've always gotten them out quite a bit backpacking. Owen's a very avid mountain biker. Eli really kind of prefers to play video games and stuff. However, and I taught them both to hunt, and they've both elk hunted and deer hunted and stuff like that. I kind of ruined them as fishermen because at a young age, I told them that they had to eat what they caught, and they decided that they didn't like fish at the time, as most young kids do. So they're kind of like, screw this fishing stuff. So I took them to Alaska salmon fishing because I figured, you know, getting reds and silvers on, that's a whole different game than a little trout and could be quite the hoot, right? And they had a good time with that. So we did 2-3 days of salmon fishing as a family. Then we drove to Tok. And to go back further, my wife and I bought a van up in Alaska this year. We went up there fishing around the 4th of July. And we bought a slightly wrecked van and turned it into a camper van via some stuff that we bought at Fred Meyer and Sportsman's to kind of make a sleeping platform, and threw a bed in it and tooled around fishing for a while. So we had that van. And so then we drove to Tok. One of our employees, Nathan, was joining us. He's worked for us. He was instrumental in the pack design. He's been kind of part of our orbit for a long time. And then a mutual friend, Jeff, who we now consider the Seek Outside physical therapist. Jeff was an early on pack customer who got himself in a pickle on an elk hunt and was calling around trying to find someone who would help him pack this bull from a really nasty area. And someone said, doesn't your pack maker live somewhere out there? And sure enough, I was elk hunting that morning, but I got derailed helping a semi truck driver who broke down on my way to my elk hunting spot. And so I got that message and I said, okay, why not go see how this customer is doing with his pack? So we hiked up about 4,500 feet to where he was at. He was up very high at tree line 12.5. Long story short, he's been kind of a friend in our orbit ever since then, right? So the two boys from Tennessee, they show up in Fairbanks. They rent a U-Haul truck because it's all they could get. They drive to Tok. We do a weigh-in and stuff with 40-mile air. And we fly in somewhere north, about an hour and 20 minutes worth of flight time, somewhere kind of in that northeast Alaska area. And it was good. We landed. It was low cloud deck. We were camped kind of high at about 3,600 feet. The other three of us, we all kind of went our own ways looking for caribou, and all three of us got pretty nice bulls. And we texted the In Velvet, and we texted the transporter, and we weren't sure if we wanted to stay and hang around and just watch animals. And they told us some more weather was coming in. And given that we had all these caribou in velvet, we wanted to and they were in really nice velvet. We wanted to really preserve the velvet. We decided to go out the next day. So we went out, and then we spent the night in Tok and drove back to Fairbanks and found an expediter and hopped on an airplane again and came back home. So it was a remarkable experience. Every one of us would turn around and do it again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, but you're in Colorado and there's some pretty impressive stuff to do around there too, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We have some pretty rugged country. I used to do some ultra running. I used to do a lot of mountaineering kind of stuff. We have a lot more tourists. We just don't have that kind of remoteness that you do. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of elk. We also have a lot of elk hunters. It's really hard, unless you're in a limited unit, to get away from somebody. But our guess is we were 120, 140 miles from Tok. It was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw wolverines. We don't have wolverines. Saw wolves. We have a few wolves, but I don't really want to see wolves around here. I didn't mind seeing them so much up there.
Mm-hmm. I was actually born in Rocky Ford, Colorado, and my family lived in Ordway, Colorado, until we moved up when I was 5 to Alaska. And my wife now, our first date was actually at Gilpin Lake, which I think is at the Mount Zirkle Wilderness.
I think so. I'm on the west side, so I'm not very familiar with. I go to Denver on occasion, but it's probably less than once a year.
Yeah, there's no need to go over there. You're in Grand Junction, is that right?
Our facility, our operations is in Grand Junction. I actually live 2 hours south at the edge of the San Juans in a little town between two little towns called Ouray and Ridgeway.
Okay.
They're kind of tourist towns. They're a little bit across the mountains from Telluride, but it's steep, rugged, beautiful country.
Mm-hmm. My wife and I camped in, I think it was near Montrose, where the... Mm-hmm. Is it the Black Canyon of the Gunnison and the Gunnison River down there that we fished that mm-hmm. and camped there? And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, the Black is pretty impressive. I live basically at the edge of the mountain range south of Montrose.
Cool.
So yeah, I mean, I'm at the little end of a valley, and I don't know, the valley is maybe a half mile wide, and there's mountains on either side.
Yeah. Yeah, some beautiful territory, super rugged. It's impossible to really compare. Like, it's so unique. Colorado is so different, so unique. And then you look at Alaska, it's so different, so unique. It's almost impossible to say which one is better. Because then you're looking at, well, Alaska might be better just because you don't have the sheer amount of people.
But yeah, there's some areas of Alaska that there's some areas of Alaska that I told my wife before I'd been up there couple times before, I said, it's kind of like our area, but it's on steroids, you know?
Yeah.
Like I think the Kenai is that parts of the Kenai, like the Cooper Landing area, is similar to this. I mean, okay, we do not have the Kenai River. That is incredible, you know.
Yeah.
But as far as the mountains and the vegetation, heck, they even have beetle kill in Cooper Landing, mm-hmm. which is, we have beetle kill here too much of it. Yeah. You guys probably don't, being in the southeast coastal part, but there's some similarities. There's some things that are uniquely Alaska, some things that are probably uniquely here. There's some areas of Alaska that are just really hard to compare. And then the hunting and fishing in Alaska, well, the hunting and fishing is good here. It's Alaska's at a different level.
Yeah. Thing I liked about Cooper Landing is it isn't so developed. It feels like it's still behind, which is nice. Some of these places you look at and you get the impression that, man, this Kenai River would have been awesome, you know, 2-3 decades ago when you were getting a ton of those 60-pound kings that were coming up, and then bigger fish too. But now it's not what it was. But Cooper Landing, just as a community, it seems a little kind of old school, not super propped up, developed, and on the map yet. But definitely liked it.
Yeah, even the touristy spots of some of Alaska are still pretty down home-ish in a way. Like Homer, you know, it's touristy, right? It's world-renowned, but it's also really got a lot of homesteading and gardening and stuff like that, you know, still.
Are there some other places that you've been that, you go out and you adventure and you camp? Like, how many days are you, like a year, are you going out and finding new areas outside of the state?
Not enough. I am planning to try to take the bulk of the time off this winter, and just be in communication and manage some of the design stuff. We finally have our company to where it seems to operate fairly well without my day-to-day involvement, which is good. I mean, there's other areas I love to go. I think the Gila is pretty cool, down in New Mexico. I think some areas in southern Arizona close to the Mexico border are pretty cool in the winter. I love some of the areas of Idaho, Montana, Washington, stuff like that. But there's more I would like to see. Then I have a couple areas that I just won't tell. That
good.
Because I've seen what has happened. You know, I've seen even where I live, you know, it was 6 hours from any major city when I moved here. You know, it's still 6 hours from any major city, but a lot more people make the drive now, you know. And so, I mean, places like Moab, they've gotten overdone. It's to crazy. Where it's like,
yeah,
it's like the skip, you know. I think my son went there for his friend's birthday, and it took them 3 hours to drive like the last 10 miles into Moab.
Yeah. Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
It's really awesome that people have the opportunity to go to these places. You know, any place that you've been, it's the same thing. Like, you know, I've been there. I did the pilgrimage or go there, and you see that beautiful thing. There's just so many people that these areas are on their list to go to, and so you want them to have the opportunity. But then it's just not going to be what it was. Ketchikan is like that. In the 90s, it was mostly a fishing and logging town. But when the logging went out, the pulp mill went out, it had to reinvent itself out of necessity. And so now it's cruise ship town, and some of the older locals lament the cruise ships, and you have a community of 10,000 people, and then you have 10,000 people off the cruise ships in a day, and over 1 million over the summer. But there really wasn't much of an alternative. You have to have some sort of economic engine, and if the resource development isn't happening the way it was, something's got to replace it. And if it's tourism, then, you know, Ketchikan is a lot more about those kind of jewelry shops and touristy shops downtown. And so it's nice that economically it's a healthy community, and we're able to have the things as a result of the tax revenue and the visitors. But, you know, it does come at the cost maybe of some of that down home feel, but who knows what it would be. Would it have dried up if they didn't go full fledged tourism? Who knows?
No, I agree. And my business has spent a lot of time trying to get people outside, trying to motivate people outside. And I feel really happy for what we've done, but there's a few spots that I just don't share on my social media and stuff anymore. Just because I want to keep them a little under, and I'm like, everyone else, you guys go have fun at all these other really incredible spots. And yeah, there is the balance of industry. There's a show I used to watch that I liked that was on in the 90s called Northern Exposure, Fake Town.
And, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. But you saw that there. That was this little tiny, you know, even though it was TV, it was this little tiny rural town, right? Way out in the sticks. But then you had Maurice trying to develop it into what the Alaskan Riviera or whatever it was, he called it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you will always have someone who goes somewhere and says, wow, I could develop this into, you know, and I mean, entrepreneuring and stuff is part of our spirit. And so it's hard to find fault with that at all. Yeah. You just have to keep looking. I mean, I will say, and I'm not trying to get the Gila exploited down in New Mexico, but I had a fantastic time down there last year. I spent about 10 days car camping, and for bathing, I would find a hot spring to hike to usually. And, you know, for a few days, I was an hour away from cell service, and just going and hiking and doing stuff with my dog. The bird hunting wasn't really good, but I have faith that the bird hunting will probably be a lot better this year. Once again, I'm not trying to promote tourism down there, but no, I had a great time, and it wasn't overpopulated by any means.
I think that's part of the, as advocates for the outdoor, like I'm an outdoor writer, I do a podcast. And so there's, you know, people are listening. They might be excited about doing something based on what they hear, but I hope that part of what they hear is the attitude of, you know, I want people to do these things, but also to know that you're visiting someone else's backyard. And so hopefully when they do go, it's, you know, with that sort of, I don't know, reverence or whatever. I mean, it's not yours because it's all of ours, you know, back we're the public landowner thing, but that doesn't mean we're necessarily entitled. So I think the way it's presented is, can help. And that's I'm a good guest when I go somewhere else too, and I keep that in mind.
That's probably the big one. And I'll tell you, one of the pet peeves around here is that people come from their cities, right? And I'm not trying to make fun of city folk, right? But they come from their cities where they're used to cleaning up their dog's poop, right? And I get it. It's nice to clean up after your dog, but they have a tendency to take them on trails and then put their dog's poop in a baggie and leave the baggie.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's worse than the problem that was there in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, I would have rather you just didn't clean up after your dog and you took a stick and swept it off the trail. I mean, there's poop in the woods. There's coyote poop. There's lots of animals poop in the woods. You know, it doesn't bother me that much, but what it does bother me seeing a bunch of baggies filled with poop in the woods.
Yeah. It's so ironic because, and that's kind of the mind frame. It's here's what I'm supposed to do because there's an ordinance that says I have to do it. And then someone else is going to come up behind me and they're going to pick it up, like someone lower on the food chain. When you go to those areas where you don't have that service, like you're out here.
Yeah.
So like, there's no one that's cleaning up after the day.
Yeah, I mean, I might eventually take a trash bag and do it, but it's not something that I enjoy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think it's an important thing when you are traveling to these different areas to just kind of take a second to maybe get an idea of what's going on, and really kind of appreciate the local vibe too. And, you know, meet some people, talk to some people. And, you know, when people come up here to go fishing at these lodges, you know, some of the people just totally ignore the fact that, you know, who's cutting your fish, who's vacuum packing the fish, what's the story, you know, and it's some kid who wants to go to, you know, college down south, or, you know, it's not just some kid who's earning money to just stick around here. You know, they want to go to Santa Clara, or they got accepted to Harvard, or, you know, or they went to the high school here and they won the state championship basketball. You know, it's, you miss out on so much if you don't talk to the people who live here year round. You know, it's not just, this doesn't exist just for you to travel to. Like, there's a whole story, and that's a really rich part of the experience.
I ran into a kid last year when I was down in the Gila. I hesitate to call him a kid. He was probably mid-30s or 40, right? And he worked at a fishing lodge in Southeast Alaska in the summer. And in the winter, he tools around the Southwest in his van, kind of dirt bagging and hiking and having a good time with the money that he's made from summer. And then in the summer, he goes up and works at a fishing lodge.
That's cool.
You know, yeah, there's all sorts of stories, you know, of how people got where they are or are doing what they are. And it's just the same, like you were saying, talking to people, learning a little bit about it, you know, and a lot of times they do have pretty interesting stories.
So when you do go on your trips, what do you take? I'm assuming you take one of your own products. Or do you have a couple at your disposal? If you're heading north, you take a certain one. If you're heading south, you take something else.
The reality is it is all over the board. The reality is that when we went up on our caribou hunt this year, we had two prototype tents, and then a couple that we produce. And so it was a mix of them. There's other times when I grab a Cimarron or Red Cliff, it's hard to go wrong with one of those, and they're insanely popular, for a reason. There's other times when, you know, I could make a case for a big teepee, sure would be nice. Did a family camp out over the weekend, and, you know, everyone was just in whatever. Some people were in campers, some were sleeping in the back of their truck, and there's some friends. The weather was kind of brutal. We were up by timberline, and it was kind of reminded us of our Alaskan caribou hunt. Wet and windy and cold. I certainly could have said, like, man, I kind of wish we would have brought a big teepee. You know, it would have been a great place to hang out and, you know, stuff, you know. So it kind of is all over the board. It depends on if it's a backpacking trip or a car camping trip. There's times, like, I've done trips to Alaska where I rented a U-Haul van and took backpacking gear and put it down in the back of the U-Haul van and tooled around, and it was a budget camper van, you know?
Yeah. What is the difference between, like, the four-person teepee and then your Red Cliff?
Shape. It really is. The four-person teepee does really well in the wind and severe weather. But the Red Cliff does well enough, and the Red Cliff space is a little more conducive for orienting people for sleeping. And then it also has some insert options for, like, nests in case you're worried about bugs. So it transitions between all the different seasons a little better. So, like, say if someone is in a really buggy area, like the Boundary Waters, they could use it in the summer by throwing a nest in there, and they could use it in the winter with, like, sled dogs without, if they wanted. So that's a big part of it.
Awesome. Well, that's about all I got. Been about 50 minutes or so. So I really appreciate your time and thanks for making a quality product. Do you have any closers, thoughts, ideas, ways that people can find your tents, order the tents, follow you guys on Instagram, see if they want to get a tent?
We are at seekoutside.com, not Seek Outdoors. Some people confuse that. Seek Outside, all one word. Our YouTube is Seek Outside. Our Instagram is Seek Outside. Our Facebook is Seek Outside. We have a fairly large Facebook group as well. A lot of people share tips, tricks, ask questions on there. We pride ourselves on our customer service. We really try to give the best advice we can from an outdoorsman perspective, not from the, that we're trying to sell you a product. We'd be happy to, get people quality products. But if there's something else you prefer better, then there's no harm in that either.
Great. Well, thanks again. Really appreciate it. And take care and enjoy some caribou.
Will do. Will do. I can't wait to get mine back. It's taking the refrigerated truck down, and then it's going to be my taxidermist. And I hope that comes out great, because it was an incredibly beautiful animal.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.